I just got this downstairs overnight from my speechwriter. Thank you, Carolyn. She didn't know she was coming. So she overnighted it. How nice of her. And I'm going to move right along because I hope that you'll stay. Not long ago, I was sitting in the lobby of a Virginia social services center waiting to interview the director. I hadn't been there long when a woman came crashing through the door, unkempt, quite disoriented, clearly not well. "Where's my check?" she shouted. "Sit down," said the secretary receptionist behind two layers of bulletproof glass. Now compare that scene to the parable of the Good Samaritan. Picture the robbery victim. When the Good Samaritan pulls him out of the ditch, the victim says, "Thank you." When the Samaritan pulls him out of the ditch, he says, "No, thank you for letting me serve you, a brother in Christ." "Sit down." "Thank you." These two visions of charity are in conflict today, and that conflict has a history, a rationale, and a troubled future. Now, you don't have to be Catholic to know that charity must be voluntary. Since Aristotle, Western man has understood that only voluntary acts can be called virtuous. And the Christian believes that charity is the ultimate theological virtue. So government charity is an oxymoron. That's my bumper sticker tonight. The very notion of something called mandatory charity is Orwellian, doublethink. But it is also a danger, a dagger aimed at the heart of true voluntary charity, which is born of freedom, virtue, and yes, sanctifying grace. A Christian could hardly call it noble to take money from a man by force, give it to a third party, and pat himself on the back for his virtuous generosity. But this temptation has become so much a part of American political life that I think Christians have hardly noticed with what ease the state has put true charity on the cross. With the authority of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the intellectual godfather of the French Revolution, the government today feels empowered to force us to be free. Now, the student of political theory recognizes that assertion as a fundamental dialectical contradiction. Alas, the average bureaucrat considers it just another day at the office. Consider today's liberal. He might shrug and ask, "Why didn't this Samaritan guy just call 9/11? A professional EMT could have rescued the man in the ditch, and the Samaritan would not have run the risk of a liability suit. The taxpayer would pay the cost, which is much fairer, at least to the Samaritan and to the man in the ditch. The Samaritan would still have his money, and the man in the ditch would not have to thank anybody. Why? After all, he is entitled to emergency services and free health care from the government. The Samaritan could return home happily, congratulating himself for having done his good deed for the day. Now, in its own self-interest, today's government charity machine might want to peddle this alternative reality, but today we embrace it at our peril. It is admittedly ever more difficult in the political realm to raise the issue of the seventh commandment, "Thou shalt not steal." In fact, it's not hard at all in this time zone to understand why the government prohibits the posting of the Ten Commandments in government offices. It's just not good for employee morale. Now, St. Emily de Villar, whose feast we celebrate today, is a wonderful example of true Christian charity. This woman donated her own house, used her own money, and founded the Congregation of Sisters of St. Joseph of the Apparition in 1835. Her sisters cared for the needy, especially the sick, and established numerous schools. Her congregation is now active all over the world. St. Emily did all this without the government, but with unbounded love. In the same spirit of Christian charity, countless European religious orders did the same wondrous works in America throughout the 19th century. They founded Notre Dame. In his City of God, Augustine points to love as the central determining act in history. The state can only maintain a modicum of peace, justice, and concord. It is the church, inseparable from Christ, that preaches and practices caritas. The state at its best can only dispense justice. Now, Pope Benedict XVI, in his encyclical Deus Caritas, asks with Augustine, without justice, what is the state but a band of robbers? Well, today, we know the answer all too well. Yes, Christians are still permitted in the public square, but they are mocked, assaulted, and targeted for co-option or extinction by the ruling agents of the culture of death. And, barring a miracle, it's only going to get worse. Caritas is a constant theme for Pope Benedict. Last week, on the Feast of Corpus Christi, he said, "Love transforms everything, and so we understand that the mystery of transubstantiation, the sign of Jesus' charity, which transforms the world, is at the center of today's feast, and I would add of today's world." The Pope makes it very plain. Christian love is the only force that can improve the world. Government force simply cannot transform the world or change human nature, although, with the authority of Rousseau and Marx, tyrants will try to force it. If you love Big Brother, he will transform you. In room 101 of The Mystery of Love, he will torture you until you believe firmly that 2 + 2 = 5. Big Brother agrees with Rousseau. In order for the general will, which Socrates properly identifies as the tyrant's worst nightmare, for the tyrant's will to prevail, man must be forced to be free. Then, and only then, can he be put in charge of the bailouts. In today's world, I think that the lust for power and envy are the secret sins. When they do prosper, none dare call them by their proper names. After all, envy, covetousness, merits 2 commandments. And in his first epistle, St. John the Evangelist warns against superbia vitae, the lust for power, the pride of life. We rarely hear about them amidst taunts attacking the decade of greed and demanding social justice. But envy and the lust for power are the driving forces behind today's attack on Christian charity. Government charity is not only a theoretical contradiction, it is a disaster in practice. Most of you can describe its nefarious consequences better than I, so I won't detail them tonight. If you need to brush up on the particulars, just see Richard Vigory. He'll be glad to put you on all of his mailing lists, and you'll hear about them plenty. Allow me to propose the recent collapse of one major American nonprofit as a metaphor for the rest. I have in mind, of course, General Motors. GM's new chairman, a Mr. Whitaker, appointed by the government, now admits he knows nothing about cars. Well, at least there's one honest government employee. Here's a test for government charity. Would you buy a used car from this man? Many years ago, I got to know Father Raymond de Jager, a longtime missionary in China. He was imprisoned by the communists when they took over the country. Father de Jager was sent to a communist re-education camp, where he got quite a surprise. They didn't bother to teach Mao's Little Red Book, which I brought along tonight. It was all Darwin, all evolution, all the time. Imagine. Today, 89% of American students attend public schools that offer that very same curriculum. What progress mankind has made in just 60 years! Along with his brutal attack on truth, Chairman Mao drove another dagger into the heart of charity. in the some 900,000 villages throughout China, with an average population of about 1,000 villagers each, Mao made sure that the backbreaking work schedule never allowed one free moment. No leisure. Every night, impoverished Chinese peasants were forced to attend one meeting after another in the village hall. There, they were subjected to endless prating about water, electricity, women's health, including the schedule of pregnancies and forced abortions, irrigation, and, of course, required classes in evolution and political indoctrination. No leisure, no freedom, no possibility of charity. Now, as a faithful fan of St. Thomas, I do believe that it is possible for a government to serve the common good. But prudential observation should inform us today that our government, our current government, serves another master. This regime is simply not functioning according to what our Declaration of Independence calls the laws of nature and of nature's God, who alone can bestow upon us our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Juan Donoso Cortes observed in the 19th century that liberalism can exist only in that brief moment in which society decides Christ or Barabbas. In America, that brief moment is ending. If our diverse society, devoted to the dictatorship of relativism, makes no decision, then another principle comes into play. As an old friend of mine used to put it, the only way you can coast is downhill. Times are hard. Our country is getting close to the point where many noble charitable enterprises will not be able to survive without government grants and government tolerance. First, the withdrawal of government funding alone could kill many charities that have come to depend on it, and it could impair many more. But second, government policy can also kill and maim. There's harassment, the FEC, hate crimes legislation, the Thought Police, Homeland Security, the IRS. Today, Connecticut is even using lobbying laws to muzzle the Catholic Church. It never ends. Let me count the ways. No, ask Richard Viguerie. Get on his list. Conservatives have long attacked the sins of big government, and with good reason. What puzzles me is the apparent acquiescence of many conservatives, virtually the entire nonprofit community, and especially the churches, including my own Catholic Church, as the government virtually expropriates the dispensation of what was once universally recognized as Christian charity. Think about it for a minute. Sure, in charitable terms, today the government might seem to be a benefactor. After all, Catholic Charities USA alone receives over two-thirds of its budget from government funds, over $2 billion a year. But tomorrow, that's $2 billion, but tomorrow the bill might come due. Government regulations that require Catholic institutions to give abortion referrals, provide contraceptives, or to allow irregular partners to participate in insurance plans and to adopt Catholic children put up for adoption. That's tomorrow. What about the day after tomorrow? Catholic higher education receives billions more. Yes, Notre Dame alone receives some $50 million every year in government grants. They receive possibly even more from NBC Sports. Their spokesman will not reveal that sum. An NBC official in New York tells a priest friend of mine that NBC gives Notre Dame more every year than all the alumni put together. As we see, Notre Dame cheerfully dances to the piper's tune. And if they don't, well, a slow death can be administered in sophisticated ways, kind of like euthanasia. A government doesn't have to send in the stormtroopers, not these days. A memo to a few hundred well-placed and dependable government bureaucrats would do nicely, merely telling them that their agencies should, change their funding priorities. Now, this is nothing personal, but even some of our conservative friends have gotten little pieces of the pie. After all, don't we all appreciate a little nod of recognition from Caesar now and then? To put it another way, if Big Brother is watching you, why not try to make him smile? Even wink. Well, whatever happened to Barry Goldwater? Permit me to read from The Conscience of a Conservative, a book whose galleys I helped to proofread on our kitchen table in 1960 when my father published it because no one else would. Here is Goldwater. Quote, "I have little interest in streamlining the government or in making it more efficient, for I mean to reduce its size. I do not undertake to promote welfare, for I propose to extend freedom. My aim is not to pass laws, but to repeal them. It is not to inaugurate new programs, but to cancel old ones that do violence to the Constitution," end quote. That was 1960. Doesn't it seem like so long ago and far away? Well, as usual, Stan Evans puts it colorfully. Conservatives come to Washington knowing that it's a sewer. The trouble is most of them wind up treating it like a hot tub. Our dear and departed old friend Paul Weyrich, fully in character, put it more bluntly. Never give to your friend any power which your enemy might one day inherit. Well, folks, in the past 40 years, both parties have given their friends a lot of power, and now our enemy has inherited it. Permit me a word or two about my favorite nonprofit, the Catholic Church. Have you ever listened to NPR? Their oily voices routinely thank viewers like you for their funding. Not once in 30 years have I ever heard them thank the taxpayer, even though they would not exist without him. Of course, NPR's editorial policy returns the favor, not to the taxpayer, but to the government, quite dependably. Similarly, the typical Catholic in the pews never hears the pastor thank him as a taxpayer for the billions of dollars that the federal government provides to Catholic charities, Catholic hospitals, Catholic educational institutions. Now, do these Catholic institutions ever return the favor? I report, you decide. The USCCB, the bishop's bureaucracy in Washington, steadily emits an endless ooze of position papers that seem to materialize out of Teilhard de Chardin's fictitious new sphere. And a fan of his is here tonight, so I had to give Chardin credit where the new sphere is due. These position papers invariably support the agenda of the most liberal faction in Congress, which just happens to be that same powerful faction that could shut down the generous federal funding of Catholic programs in a heartbeat. The sole agenda exception here, of course, is the life issues, or at least some of them. Consider, how often do you hear complaints from the USCCB regarding federal funding of family planning programs, except when they include abortion? I hasten to add here that I find today an excellent article on the conference website articulating the damage done by the contraceptive revolution. It was written by our dear friend, Dr. John Perselski, who delivered our daughter, Carolyn, who is with us tonight, and many, many more of our friends and their kids. Yes, Dr. Perselski is a wonderful man, but he is not a bishop. Well, moving right along. In recent years, I have become increasingly intrigued by the juxtaposition of these two Catholic conference agendas, pro-life, pro-left. What explains the contradiction? For a while, when I first realized how much money, it was stunning, was changing hands, I thought that it just might be another case of political tit for tat. I'm sure that's how most politicians on Capitol Hill view it. You know, scratch my back, endorse my agenda, and I'll scratch yours, give you other people's money. After all, how much is the seal of approval of the Holy Roman Catholic Church worth? Priceless? Well, I personally think that it's worth a lot more than a measly $2 billion a year. Then a couple of years ago, pro-abortion Catholic Patrick Leahy, the chairman, superbia vitae, of the Senate Committee on the Judiciary, was asked by a Capitol Hill reporter about Pope Benedict's approval of the exclusion of some pro-abortion politicians from reception of the Eucharist, and a response that has somehow escaped widespread attention, Leahy took dead aim. "I've always thought that those bishops and archbishops who for decades hid pederasts should be indicted," he responded. His press secretary didn't even know he had said this. Is that a shot across the bow? Well, as we all know, Senator Leahy has subpoena power. And as Phil Lawler has pointed out in his excellent book, The Faithful Departed, only a very small percentage of priests were involved in the scandals, but a majority of bishops covered up for them. So I thought that perhaps Senator Leahy's veiled threat might be a contributing cause of the bishop's willingness to accommodate the status quo regarding both government funding and the reception of the Eucharist by pro-abortion politicians. I mean, most of them by now must be really tired of lawyers. Then, of course, there's party loyalty. After all, most of our bishops, like most Catholics my age, like me, grew up in Democratic families, back when everybody, Democrats, Republicans, even Planned Parenthood, thought that abortion is murder. Could that explain it? Well, times have changed. This government is the culture of death, enthroned. Here is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton giving testimony before Congress last April. "The full force of the U.S. government will be used to get governments to change their laws on abortion all over the world." This is indeed a band of robbers, even more, a band of killers. I can't believe that our bishops agree with them, so why do they continue to cooperate so closely with them? Would our leaders dither while the worm turns for the worse? In my search for an answer, I've come to believe that there's more to it than money, or fear, or tradition, family tradition, or even ideology. I believe that a powerful reason for the church's continued love affair with the federal government lies in a long and deeply embedded tradition, not the tradition and teaching of the Catholic Church, but a unique cultural tradition of the American Catholic Church going back a couple of hundred years. In the autumn of 1916, my father was a graduate student at the Catholic University of America in Washington. He had headed up Catholics for Wilson, and on election night, 1916, he led the cheers outside the headquarters of the Democrat National Committee, singing, "We want Wilson one time more. We want peace. We don't want war." On a winter day a few months later, Dad was feeling pretty low. He was trudging through the snow to get the mail, his duty as the youngest student in the dorm, and a priest picked up his pace beside him and chatted him up. He listened to my father's lament, how he and most of his classmates would probably never finish their PhDs because they were all going to be drafted now that American entry in the war seemed all but inevitable. "Why, you're just a young man," said the priest. "You should have great expectations. You know your Dickens. You just have to have great expectations. Don't worry. Everything will be fine." He walked with my dad for a few minutes and really cheered him up, as my father gratefully recounted to me 50 winters later. As they drew near the post office, my father told the kindly old priest, "Father, I have to turn off here, but it's been nice talking to you. My name's Pat Mannion. What's yours?" The old priest smiled and replied, "I'm Cardinal Gibbons." Who was Cardinal Gibbons? Well, 100 years ago, he was the most prominent and powerful Catholic Church leader in America. Some background brief is in order. In 1785, John Carroll, who later became the first archbishop in the United States, took note of an important cultural reality in America. "We desire," he said, "that whoever can We desire that whatever can, with safety to religion, be granted, shall be conceded to American Catholics in ecclesiastical affairs. In this way, we hope that distrust of Protestants, now full of suspicion, will be diminished and that our affairs can be more solidly established. These Protestant suspicions go back to the roots of the Reformation, of course, perpetuating the canard that Catholics cannot be loyal to their nation because of their spiritual loyalty to a foreign pope. These suspicions played a powerful role in American history, and not only church history, throughout the 19th century. John Jay, I was surprised to learn, our first Supreme Court justice, led a powerful anti-Catholic faction in New York in the 1780s. The other highlights you already know. The Know-Nothings, Horace Mann and his anti-Catholic public school campaign, Rum, Romanism and Rebellion in 1884, and years of controversy regarding education, the American church's relationship to Rome, and much more. A fascinating and already well-documented century. Archbishop Gibbons rose to prominence in the 1860s when all these suspicions were in full bloom. He returned to Baltimore, his hometown, in 1877. At first one of the youngest bishops in the world, he became America's second cardinal and the leader of the American church for decades. For our purposes, we will focus on his intense desire to make American Catholics part of the mainstream, to end the Catholic ghetto mentality, and to prove that Catholics could be loyal Americans. As his biographer, Ellen Sinclair Will, puts it, Gibbons felt that the foreigners here had all to gain and nothing to lose by falling in unreservedly with the national destiny of America. Falling in unreservedly. Note the military terminology. When war broke out in Europe in 1914, Gibbons at first championed peace, but only so long as Wilson did. His desire to prove that Catholics were good Americans precluded his taking an independent stance as American involvement grew ever nearer. Already on July 23, 1916, he advocated universal military training to, quote, safeguard the nation, build up manhood, and fuse its foreign strains. He did not support the Catholics who opposed U.S. entry into the war. Ellen Will recounts that, quote, once Congress declared war on Germany on April 6, 1917, he called on every American citizen to do his duty, to uphold the hands of the president and the legislative department in the solemn obligation that confronts us. The primary duty of a citizen is loyalty to his country, end quote. This, even for a president who had won re-election because he kept us out of war. To continue, under the leadership of Gibbons, the Catholics of the United States were the first religious body to pledge their full and active support to the government, end quote. And on July 23, 1917, Gibbons told the recruits for the immense army that was then forming, be Americans always. Remember that you owe all to America, and be prepared, if your country demands it, to give all in return. Secretary of War Newton Baker later estimated the number of Catholics in the military and naval service at approximately one-third of the total force, although Catholics formed only one-sixth of the population. During the war, Gibbons set up the National Catholic War Conference to coordinate war efforts of Catholic organizations, including the Knights of Columbus. Carl Anderson, currently the Supreme Knight, tells me that my father played a central role there during the war years. Gibbons later wrote that the NCWC, quote, united in patriotic effort all Catholic organizations. It has brought international expression to the Catholic principles of justice and fraternal service that bespeak the continued prosperity and happiness of America as a nation. After the war, Gibbons decided that the NCWC had been so effective that, quote, we have determined for the end of peace to maintain the spirit of union and coordination through the National Catholic Welfare Council. Under its discretion, our needs and problems in the several fields of education and social reform will be carefully studied. For Cardinal Gibbons, the alliance of the new permanent council, later called the conference, with the government came naturally. Government was more than our friend for the cardinal, It was a divinely inspired leader. In his New Year's sermon at the Baltimore Cathedral, January 3, 1920, Gibbons said, "Has not America played the part of the Good Samaritan during the late World War? Have not the American people been Good Samaritans to prostrate and bleeding Europe? Has America not aided those who were largely of a different race, language, and religion? She has sacrificed her sons on the altar of patriotism that they might free them from the yoke of bondage." Now, John Howard, my friend in Rockford, and my father 60 years ago, among others, have chronicled the fundamental role of religion and its attachment, its importance in early American life. That spirit was still alive 100 years ago. The title of one of Gibbons's biography I have here crowns him as the Prince of Democracy. But for him, our democratic government and our Constitution were good and noble. Clearly, our church's early leaders wanted to love the government as much as they wanted it to love them and us. This is for me an inescapable conclusion. During the 19th century, the marriage was interesting. By the end of the 20th, it was disastrous. Robert Nisbet once observed that in 1913, the only contact the average American had with the federal government was the post office. Well, that was then, this is now. Today, our national Good Samaritan has become the angel of death. In spite of that, Gibbons's identification of the church with the government has endured. Nay, it has become almost indelible. Ever since, it has increasingly infected the work of the organization he erected. The conference's longtime leader under FDR, Monsignor John Ryan, was humorously called the Right Reverend New Dealer. As Paul Lacoutis, my colleague at The Wanderer, points out, conference spokesman Bishop Joseph Hurley continued to consummate the union. In July 1941, Hurley announced that the bishops would support early U.S. entry into the war, 5 months before Pearl Harbor, when a vast majority of American Catholics and Americans strongly opposed it. "As for the people," Hurley said, "they have neither the experience nor the access to the facts to decide whether we go to war." In the interest of full disclosure, those inexperienced, uninformed Catholics opposed to the war included my father, at the time Dean of the Notre Dame Law School and legal advisor to General Wood, the leader of America First. Well, let's give Bishop Hurley a break. After all, he spoke before the age of the laity, which was supposedly ushered in by Vatican II. But in 1968, Bishop Joseph Bernardin became the Catholic Conference's secretary and later its president. Under the camouflage of Vatican II, he labored valiantly to impose liberal politics as the conference's permanent agenda. He succeeded. It is no wonder that today he is Obama's favorite bishop, as Obama invoked him at Notre Dame. So much for the age of the laity. It is ironic, isn't it, that liberal Catholics who hate the hierarchy and want a more democratic church are the ones who have their agenda constantly advocated by the bishops and the U.S. Catholic Conference. It's the conservatives who love the Pope and the Magisterium and who valiantly defend the bishops as the successors of the apostles, even as we so often get the back of their hands. Well, I don't know, maybe they just take us for granted. The left, they can never take for granted. Well, as T.S. Eliot says, and this and so much more. It is no surprise, although perhaps a great disappointment, that today's Bishops' Conference speaks in the name of the church as it champions virtually every item on the liberal socialist agenda, except those life issues construed narrowly. Think about it. How hard would it be for us faithful, how hard would we have to work to convince our bishops to faithfully and firmly and publicly advocate humani vitae, all of it, in the public square and the halls of Congress? In this age of the laity, As we confront the culture of death, perhaps that is the laity's greatest challenge, and the laity's great charities ought to be at the forefront of that effort. More distressingly, today the church confronts the public scandal of countless pro-abortion politicians that many of our bishops cannot find the language, the principles, or even, to put it plainly, the cardinal virtue of fortitude to deal with according to the plain language of canon law or just plain common sense. So we must ask, is our government today still Cardinal Gibbons's Good Samaritan? Where's my check? Sit down. That relatively harmless occasion has a haunting and historic parallel. When Alana Ceaușescu was dragged with her husband to the wall on Christmas 1989, after having for decades been Romania's torturing, sadistic, totalitarian ruler, her last words before the firing squad were, "But I have been like a mother to you." When Our Lady appeared to Juan Diego in 1531 at what we now call Guadalupe, she gently assured the frightened young man, "I am your mother." Ceaușescu or Guadalupe? The mother of torture or the mother of the Savior who is himself infinite truth and love? Christ or Barabbas? Government charity or Christian charity? That is the choice we must make today. Thank you. Thank you.
Fran, do we have time for a question or two?
Maybe one or two.
One or two questions. Sir. Charles Melano.
In the last few decades, at least two popes and the catechism have taught us about the principle of subsidiarity. Namely, the institution of the higher order does not interfere with the operation of the institution of the lower order as long as it's functioning. By chasing federal dollars, isn't the bishops' conference acting contrary to the principle of subsidiarity?
That's a good question. A few things apply.
We didn't all hear it.
I'm going to repeat it because it's such a good question. The principle of subsidiarity implies that what can be done at a lower level should not be done at a higher level. Isn't the pursuit of federal money by the Catholic Church a violation of that principle? Okay, we've got to make a couple of distinctions here. First of all, there are problems and there are conditions. We're all going to die. That is not a problem. That is the human condition. A condition cannot be solved. A problem can. So first of all, certain conditions have to be accepted rather than rising ever higher in a governmental effort to cure them when they are, in fact, by nature, fallen nature, incurable. Secondly, with regard to the federal government itself, we have a limited federal government by which states handle problems which the federal government is not assigned specifically to deal with. Health, education, and welfare are nowhere in the Constitution. However, let's put the question in a constitutionally acceptable mode. What if Arlington Diocese went down to Richmond and asked Richmond for funding? If that isn't a violation of subsidiarity or a violation of the province of the church and the limit of government at whatever level, I do think it's a violation of common sense and prudence, because frankly, the bishops really have to turn to us, the laity, and say, you know what? We have had our hands tied at the government trough for too long. We need you now more than ever. We're willing to be bishops. You've got to be the laity. You tithe. We'll get out of the government trough. We will lean on you. We'll cut away 90% of these useless programs that are just there to interface with the government bureaucracies already. We'll keep the ones that are worthwhile. No one will be paid, and we'll support them through tithing. Secondly, if the government harasses us, we will renounce our tax exemption. That will get the attention of the American people, and I guarantee you, because I know them, Chris Dodd and Joe Biden will run and hide under their Senate desks. In fact, in their hideaways, so no one can find them. So I don't think that it's such, I don't think it's so much a violation of the principle of subsidiarity, but of common sense. And yes, parishes all over the country find themselves taking care of families that are half as many as the members of the parish. No one gets paid. No one gets a IRS write-off. You never read about it in the paper. And this is why I'm so proud of my former colleague, Carl Anderson, who advocates, even now in these tough times, that his Knights of Columbus go out there and do more volunteering, because that is the essence of Christian charity.
Apparently, Chris does not believe in cyrogenics, which will turn death from a condition into a problem. If you have a large enough freezer, we could address this. Is there one more question? Jim Lucera.
I guess I can. John Cardinal Newman, when he was still an Anglican, realized that the game was up when he saw that Parliament was making decisions on what the church should do and how it should be organized. And he realized then that there was no third way. And he called upon the bishops of the established church to forego their perquisites and their tithes, and to become, to adopt the virtues of evangelical councils, which he did when he became a Catholic himself. He got no response from the bishops except by vituperation. Now we see that Obama has set up his own American church, and half of his cabinet or more are Catholics who have rejected the basic premises of the Catholic Church. Would you say now that Obama has set up his own version of the established church?
Yes, I've called it a parallel church and compared it to the Chinese National Patriotic Church. But that's only a preamble, because first things first, Confucius says, call things by their proper name. It is properly a parallel and heretical church. Secondly, however, what is to be done? Lenin asks that question. What is to be done is not to continue pushing forward the left-wing agenda of the U.S. Catholic Conference bureaucracy. That's simply idiocy. What is to be done is to return to basics. And that's why I believe that the Pope and everyone else I quoted tonight have motivated me to focus on charity tonight, on freedom, on voluntary virtue, the only kind of virtue that is possible. And if Obama manages to attract and recruit and destroy, and I believe this man is like a master jeweler. He knows right where the fault lines are, and he's put his very fine chisel there and tapped his federal hammer, and the Catholic, whatever unity was there, has been beautifully cleaved in twain, and three and four and five parts, even shattered. So Catholics, frankly, got to worry more about what we're going to do than what Obama's going to do. Frankly, we know what he's going to do. Bad news. What we've got to do is return to the fundamentals. Cardinal Newman called his brother bishops to poverty. They answered with vituperation. We have got to call our fellow Catholics to true charity, including to our bishops. Pray for our bishops four times a day and tell them so, and ask them to pray for us. And prayer and Christian love, which is identical with Christ himself, who is inseparable from the church, are going to be the avenues to success in this, but remember that Christ warned his apostles, in the world you will have trouble. In the world you will have Obamas and Maos and Stalins and Pol Pots and your next door neighbor sometime. But I have conquered the world. Bill, quick.
If Christians would vote the way we pray, in other words, we should not go to my knees and go to the voting booth and vote for a corrupt politician. If we would vote the way we prayed, we wouldn't be in this mess we have right now.
I couldn't say it any better. Well, back to the Master of Ceremonies. I'm very flattered and humbled that you all came tonight, and even more grateful that you stayed. I will be passing out an erratum sheet, which will be rather long, about Bob's introduction. Most of the good things were wrong, unfortunately. Most of the bad things were less.